It's National Crime Victims' Rights Week. This year's theme is support victims, build trust, engage communities.
Justice for Murdered Children held a rally in downtown Los Angeles, and as Eyewitness News reporter Carlos Granda shows us, victims' families shared their grief.
In one day, his life was cut short, and our family unit was disrupted.
13-year-old Natalia Jackson broke down in tears as she spoke about her father, who was murdered at his store back in 2013.
Not only was my father taken suddenly from us, but the safety and security and love that he gave us every day was horribly interrupted in one single moment.
This is National Crime Victims' Rights Week. Jackson and others took part in this rally to support those who have lost loved ones.
This is our week. And people need to be here supporting crime victims.
There were tense moments as Black Lives Matter came here to protest. They tried to get into the event but were held back by deputies. They say they support the victims and are here to protest the sheriff's department.
How our interests and their interests are aligned, that they should be standing with us, not standing on the most corrupt and violent sheriff in the history of Los Angeles County, and that's saying something.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and host of Crime Analyst and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director of CBS's Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the people who help victims.
Laura and Lisa, we have two very, very special guests today. They are...
Mariana Wells, the Development and Communications Specialist at the National Center. I've been working on building bridges since the launch.
And...
I'm Richard Washington, Program Manager for the National Center for Victims of Crime. And I manage our Building Bridges project, as well as our Project Safe Neighborhoods initiative. And I've been with the National Center for a little bit over 4 years.
Well, it's great to have both of you. We're really excited. And of course, the fact that you both work for the National Center for Victims of Crime just dovetails so much with what the work we're trying to do, not only in our careers, but with our podcast and all the people across the country and around the world. Thank you for the work that you do in helping victims of crime deal with the system and survive and thrive.
Thank you for giving us this platform.
Well, we're excited to have you on, and we want to hear a lot more about the work that you're doing. Because I think that out there, there's not so much awareness actually about what you're doing, and you're obviously doing some very innovative work. So should we dive into that? Do you want to say a little bit about the center first of all, and then we'll talk about building bridges?
The National Center for Victims of Crime is essentially an advocacy organization that works with survivors of all crime types. So that could be if the crime occurred 2 weeks ago or 20 years ago. And we do this because trauma has no expiration date. And it's incredibly important that we provide these services. We help victims of crime rebuild their lives. And we do this through a combination of training, technical assistance, direct service through our local and national hotlines, and through innovative projects such as Building Bridges.
That's awesome. And Richard, you run the Building Bridges program, don't you?
Yes. So I take care of the day-to-day activities and provide some oversight over the budgets and just making sure that we are getting our deliverables and our activities accomplished on a timely basis.
All right. So tell us, what is Building Bridges and what are the goals and objectives?
The Building Bridges Project is a grassroots community-centered project that aims to address why many victims from communities of color don't access the services that should be provided to them. And so essentially, the project is going to build a bridge between criminal justice professionals in Los Angeles and communities of color. So we are partnering with four branches of the Los Angeles NAACP. The NAACP stands for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. in different avenues and different topics and subjects, they are the voice for communities of color in particular. And they're giving us that engagement support. And we're really looking to expand the project and let everyone know about the good work that our two organizations are looking to do.
Those four branches, why are they branches? Are they in different regions of LA? Or do they do different functions? Explain to people who maybe don't know the setup.
So we're partnering with the San Pedro Wilmington branch, the City of Los Angeles branch, the Santa Monica Venice branch, as well as the Hollywood Hills Hollywood branch. And we came into contact with them through the LA mayor's office, and we were connected through some of the work that they're doing with racial discrimination and sort of disparities as far as criminal justice reform goes. And so we were introduced to them in that form and fashion, and we developed a really good relationship with them. And yeah, hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the theory behind building bridges? You said that people of color are not accessing resources and they're not actually fully participating in the justice system. Why is that? What's the underlying problem there?
There's quite a few barriers, quite a few problems that we can see through the research and we can see through communications with the community. And the biggest thing is such a huge mistrust due to historical trauma, due to some of the recent events that's occurred across the country. And that's caused a lot of mistrust between the community and law enforcement officers and criminal justice agencies. And they're just not looking to them as they should be looking to them. The people that are in those positions are there to serve the community. But if there is such a mistrust for what the services that they should be providing to them, then, you know, folks aren't going to go to them and try to access them. They're not going to ask the questions. They're not going to want to be bothered. And we've seen through victimization rates, specifically for victims and survivors of color, that those are the people that are being traumatized by some of the crime rates. But those are also the people that aren't accessing those services. And that's exactly what the Building Bridges is looking to do. We're looking to build on sort of a lot of federal work and advocacy that folks are doing. And we really want to make sure that the Los Angeles community is getting a tailored fit in figuring out how to kind of build that bridge between the two.
And I think when we're talking about violence in particular, I mean, we know the Black community experience higher rates of violence. We had the same in London, by the way, when I was in the violent, well, it was called the Racial and Violent Crime Task Force in the wake of Stephen Lawrence, a young Black boy who was murdered. There was an investigation that was highly inadequate, and then there was a huge review, and the Met Police were found to be institutionally racist. Following that, the Racial and Violent Crime Task Force was set up, and we went through very similar issues thinking about, well, how do you reach communities? And then we felt actually it wasn't about reaching, it was about listening to. It was actually about interacting, which is a very different thing when people say, well, hard to reach or hard to... It puts the onus on the communities rather than the onus on law enforcement. And I actually think the onus should be on law enforcement.
You talked about a key point in our project, and I think across the globe that finally we're kind of jumping on the ship and figuring out it's the healing and it's the dialogue. People of color, communities of color they've gone through a lot through our history, not only in the United States, but across the globe. And a lot of the times we have put them in a position where they just have to get over. And I think what we are missing is that healing, is that dialogue, to give folks a platform to be able to talk about their experiences, talk about how it's affected their life, talked about the trauma that they've gone through, and also talk about their experience with law enforcement officers, with criminal justice agencies. And I think once we provide that platform for them to do that, that's going to start that healing phase. And I think that's going to be one of the best things about this project, is to start the conversation. And I don't think a lot of grants, a lot of programs, a lot of initiatives, they're not looking to do that sort of thing. So that's one thing I'm extremely proud of about this project and what we're looking to do in Los Angeles.
You're the bridge between, effectively, you're the bridge between law enforcement and the communities and the grassroots organizations that you're working with. Is that right?
Yeah. So one thing about working with the NAACP across the country, they are the voice for communities of color. And so when we are partnering with them, we are saying that we are looking to work with communities of color and create a change and create that kind of dialogue. And I think step number one was partnering with an organization that could do such a thing. And so communities of color, they look to them. for advocacy work. They look to them when there's an event that goes on across the country. And so when they start the conversation and they start engaging with community agencies and they start this dialogue, a lot of people are going to be looking to them as the leader in the charge. And that's exactly what we want from a partner as we continue this work. And so, yeah, we are trying to be the bridge. You know, the National Center has worked as being the middleman, the liaison for a long time now. And that's what works for us. And that's what we're good at. And so we are looking to do that exactly in Los Angeles.
Why did you choose Los Angeles? Why start there?
So when we're talking about Los Angeles, this project, as we've talked about, as Laura has brought in, this project is important globally, but it's also important locally. When we're talking about LA specifically, a 2020 report from the Los Angeles Office of the Inspector General found that Black residents constitute 9% of the city's population, but 31% of the arrests. Additionally, homicide nationwide is the number one cause of death for Black men. It's so high that it covers more death than the other 9 leading causes. This is a really severe issue. We're talking about generations of trauma, and we're talking about addressing this in a meaningful way without biases, without preconceptions, just by simply going in and saying, what's going on in your community? What do you need in a trauma-informed, respectful, safe way? It's hard because BBP, we call Building Bridges Project BBP. We love our acronyms. It does a lot, but at the core of it is really just active listening and understanding that individual personal change starts in this way.
I love on your website, you kind of define building bridges and you use the word reconciliation between community and law enforcement. That's not a word you hear very often. You have two sides and very little dialogue and certainly no reconciliation. So how open have these different police departments in these different regions, how open are they to this dialogue and reconciliation? What does that really look like on the ground?
We had a meeting with the LA Mayor's office, who was on board. I will give it to them. I will give it to Los Angeles. They are very forward thinking and they are very interested in providing advocacy in all avenues to their community. So I really do appreciate the conversation that we've had with them. Through them, we were introduced to the chief and deputy chief of the City of Los Angeles Police Department. We had about a 45 to 60 minute call with them discussing our goals and talking about the project and what we're looking to do. And they were on board. They were the ones who kind of introduced us to the Los Angeles branches of the NAACP. So we are fortunate enough to be working in a city that is looking to create change. They're looking to bridge those gaps. And so shout out to Los Angeles. And I appreciate their work and that they're doing over there, or they're looking to do as well.
So you have this conversation with the chief and the deputy. That's nice. They gave you 45 minutes. I mean, not to throw any shade on that, but come on.
Really?
But
are they engaging in conversations?
They are engaging in conversation. And actually, I will put that more on our coordinating this particular call. We have a lot of programs, a lot of projects at the National Center. So only an hour was built into our calendar that day. And it also doesn't help that Los Angeles is 3 hours behind the time zone. So,
well, I guess my point was like, okay, so what comes next? You have a great meeting. This is Hollywood. I have great meetings all the time, you know, where I think I'm going to be casting the next whatever. But what happens after the talk? What are the boots on the ground, actionable things that happen?
About a week after that, our executive director, Renee Williams, received a call from both the LA Mayor's office and the deputy chief. And they straight out said they were interested in the work that we're looking to do. They love the proposal. And again, they're the ones that introduced us to the NAACP. So since then, we've had calls with both the LA Mayor's office and the police chief and deputy police chief from the City of Los Angeles, just really giving them an overview of what we're looking to do as far as the partnership between us and the NAACP. And they straight out said, what do you need from us? And so that's always a good sign when you're working with city officials. A lot of the time they will hear but are they looking to actually put in the work? And so I really do appreciate them providing a space for us to come to them and talk about the project and also provide their support as well.
So let's talk about these conversations. What format are they taking or going to take? And what is the specific goals for them? What do you really hope to get out of them?
This is what we call our year one or our phase one. And it's all about assessing the community. The biggest goal that we wanted to set for ourselves in our partnership is to not go into a community and assume what their needs are. And I think that's what a lot of folks like to do. Well, we're going to come in Los Angeles. We already know that you guys just don't trust them, or you may not know what a victim advocate is, or you've never seen a mental health professional. So this first year is all about asking the community what they need. And that's the importance behind our survey, which is about a 30 to 40 question survey that asks about demographics of that particular respondent. It asks about their victimization experiences. So if they've been victimized or not, if they've been victimized as far as being a victim of burglary or simple assault or aggravated assault, or if you've lost someone to homicide, we ask about all of that in this survey. And then we kind of move on to their experiences with first responders, their experiences with victim advocates. Have they sought out services that should be provided to them? Have they heard about these services? Their experiences with law enforcement, did they feel like they understood what they were saying, or at least was trying to be trauma-informed? Did they feel like they were just dusting them off their shoulders and not really giving them too much thought? But this survey is really going to give us a first glance into what the community actually needs. And so that's really what we're trying to do in year one, is not assume and base our assumptions for training and technical assistance off of results that we gather from the community.
Mariana, what is your role in that process?
Richard and I have been working together with the NAACP, who I just want to really credit. They have been doing community engagement since before all of us were born.
I'm pretty old.
You'd be surprised. So we're working with them to distribute the survey in culturally appropriate ways. So an example of that is that the survey is going to be distributed at a Juneteenth event. We're forging partnerships in unlikely places, maybe even at the LA County Jail. We're working really collaboratively to understand where the survey can go. So my role in that is supporting Richard. I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of press releases. I do a lot of things like that. But my role is supporting those activities in the best way on the side of the National Center.
One thing about Mariana, that she is very humble. So any sort of fundraising events, which we actually have one on the 24th of June, which is our big Building Bridges Project Day of Giving. And so she put together the strategy for that. She is contacting and starting engagement and support with other organizations who we're looking to talk about the project with. So she, anything dealing with the campaign and anything dealing with fundraising, she is the woman for the job and very helpful.
So Mariana, you mentioned Juneteenth. Can you explain to our international listeners what Juneteenth is and the historical significance of it?
The significance of Juneteenth is that it's a true Independence Day. We say that it's a day of true freedom because it occurred in 1865, 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed, when news of the Emancipation Proclamation and news of freedom reached enslaved peoples in Galveston, Texas, and it has become a national holiday very, very recently.
I just wanted to explore the word community with you both. One of the things that we learned in London is actually when we use that term community, there's communities within communities within communities. So reaching every strata of a community, for example, Black women, who we don't always hear from, and particularly regarding domestic violence, sexual violence, stalking. You know, I'm very curious about how you're going to reach people who may not be established within the usual forums that particular groups might already be talking with. You know, how are you thinking and planning on engaging women in particular?
Kudos to the NAACP. They have those relationships already in Los Angeles. And it's a really good point that you bring up, specifically Black mothers, because as Mariana stated earlier, homicide rates are increasing. And across the globe, typically victim or a family who are traumatized by a homicide are people of color. And so when you're thinking about a mother losing their son, and in a lot of times we're not involving them in the conversation, especially with in conversations about victimization, that's a large mindset that we leave out. That's a large perspective that we leave out. And I think with our work with NAACP, they are very strong and very forward thinking as far as involving mothers specifically from communities of color in this conversation. So we're really looking to them to kind of make that engagement and kind of provide that support for that. But really good point, because that is a perspective that we've historically not included in this conversation of victimization.
And additionally, as we're talking about reaching communities, and I really like the way that you talked about it in terms of stratas, we have to recognize that oftentimes, even with these communities, there are culturally relevant organizations within them. They may not fit the way the mainstream views are. They may not be a 501c3 nonprofit, but the incredible thing about building bridges is that it is malleable and it takes in these perspectives so that we can truly incorporate. When we say community, it's not only the visual part, it's not only the loudest part, it's everyone, people who may not feel welcome in that larger group, whether LGBTQIA, whether youth, whether people who have been very, very harmed by the justice system. It strives to be inclusive in the letter, not only in the letter of the word, but in action, in reality.
That's great. I mean, my experience is young people in particular, we don't hear their voices, and particularly domestic violence victims. And I'm singling them out specifically because I've learned so much from listening to women from the Black community. And indeed, even when I give presentations and listening to how, you know, law enforcement or watching lots of law enforcement presentations, oftentimes there's a bias and a skew to cases that are talked about. So I think it's so important that we understand a lot of Black women in particular won't talk about their domestic violence experience. They don't feel that they can. And so how we engage them and the language we use and the trust and confidence, we have to think about that very carefully. So I'm glad that that's on your radar.
And I think it's all about your response. Historically, the response to this sort of victimization for mothers who are the leaders of their families has been sort of not seeing the importance of it, or maybe not believing them, or maybe they think they're being dramatic or making something up. And specifically, I know that due to some of my own personal experiences with law enforcement, at the age of 6 or 7, my older brother was shot, and just having to think about your mother going to the hospital, not knowing if her oldest son is going to survive to see another day. And I think I was at a time where I didn't really know what was going on, but I could understand a little bit. But I remember specifically one of the first questions that a law enforcement asked my mom was, is your son involved in a gang? Do you know anybody that would want to hurt them? And so those are the experiences that our Black mothers are going through. And then we're wondering why 10 years later, there is no trust for the criminal justice system. They don't forget nothing. I know my mom specifically doesn't forget anything. She's going to think back to 10 years ago when I sat with a law enforcement officer about a traumatizing event for my family. And you guys asked me if my son was involved in gang activity. So it's all about historical context, and we have to think about that as to why our Black mothers aren't really trusting in the criminal justice system in particular.
I'm sorry about what happened to your brother, Richard, yeah. And thank you for sharing that, because that context is very important, that the lived-in experience that you're trying to bring to the fore. And when we talk about our personal experience, we talk about cases, we talk about the storytelling that moves the needle of the hearts and minds. You know, I always say to police officers when I train them, why should anyone trust you? Because you're wearing a uniform, that doesn't mean that people are then going to tell your deepest, darkest secrets. In fact, they might well do the opposite. If you ask specific questions, if tonally you're deaf, if you stereotype, if you make judgments and assumptions, these are all barriers to anyone opening up. So I'm not surprised that your mother felt that way. I don't know what happened with your brother in the end. I hope that he's okay. Did he survive?
He did.
That's good.
I noticed on your website, you have a video that explains what building bridges is. And there's a statistic that less than 1 in 5 Black Americans feel confident that their local police would treat them with respect. So with that kind of a number, I mean, that's a huge barrier to overcome. I'm curious as to what makes you get up in the morning to continue this work, because I am sure it is so hard. And, you know, what drew you to it in the first place? Because it just must break your heart and make you very frustrated when you can't move things forward the way you'd like.
So I work with both of the projects that I manage. So the Building Bridges project, as well as the Project Safe Neighborhoods. I work every day with law enforcement and United States attorney's offices. And I would say one of the biggest things that kind of wakes me up every day and it makes me excited about the work that we're doing at the National Center is that a lot of the time, the officers that I work with on a daily basis, they are looking for change. They may not know how to come about that change. They may not know personal experiences of this sort of disparities that we talk about on a daily basis, but a lot of them really look for the change. And so I think about that when I think about the terrible experiences that some of our Black communities have gone through with law enforcement, is that at the end of the day, there are some good cops out there. There are some good criminal justice professionals out there that are looking for this build. They're looking for a healing dialogue. They're looking to rebuild relationships between them and communities of color. So that's kind of why I love doing this work.
I think, well, when you said that, the first thing that popped into my head was a quote that I'm sure isn't new to any of you: justice delayed is justice denied. What we're doing here, and what makes me very proud to be a part of this project, is that we are working collaboratively to ensure that justice is within reach, that equal access is within reach, that people feel comfortable accessing services in their community. And I agree with you. Sometimes it can be very hard, but I find strength in knowing that we are not alone in this fight, that whether here in DC or in LA or in London, there are thousands, there are tens of thousands of people who, whether motivated by individual trauma or societal trauma or historical trauma, are coming together from every walk of life, from pastors to unions to school teachers, all coming together and recognizing there is something deeply wrong here and there is a solution.
And on Richard's point, there are many good law enforcement professionals out there. Unfortunately, what happens when something goes wrong, when we have a George Floyd case of Stephen Lawrence, is that you may have built some trust and made some headway, but it goes instantly. It can take literally a second for that trust to go. And so it is about a huge culture change, isn't it? It's not anything you can create overnight. You've got to take the first steps, but it is a huge cultural shift and cultural change. And there are more people who want to take that step, certainly in my experience.
Yeah, me too.
Than there are people against it.
Yeah, you made a lot of good points there. And I always think back to one thing that's different between the responsibilities and duties of a law enforcement officer than anybody else in the world. One bad choice, one lapse of judgment can end someone else's life. And so that is something that if you're looking to go into law enforcement, that you should think about.
But we have to make sure that in this conversation, people on both sides of the dialogue understand that it is wrong to ascribe the deeds of some bad people to all people who look or are in the same profession as the bad person was. And the fact is, there's somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million law enforcement officers in this country. I've heard statistics on both sides of that. I don't know for sure what it's down to, but at least 17,000 different law enforcement agencies in this country. It's a massive profession. There are lots of people. And there are hundreds of millions, and that's not over exaggeration, hundreds of millions of law enforcement citizens interactions a day. Every day, people have to understand that it is a tiny but significantly important fraction of those that end in violence between police officers and the public, and in particular, police officers and people of color. But they're not the rule. They are not what law enforcement officers are trained to do. In fact, Laura and I have spent a good part of our careers training law enforcement officers, as she said, to listen, to know the right questions to ask and the right way to ask them, but then listen to the answers. And certainly your mother's experience and your experience as a child is something that we can learn from. I worked at the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, and we looked at police citizen encounters. We looked at all violent crimes in the United States, And we tried to then extrapolate from that, do research, empirical studies, and then share that information with law enforcement across the country and around the world. That is an ongoing effort. That is something that we've been doing since the 80s, 40 years now. But it's not something that people know about. However, we do believe that because of social media, this information, the things that go out there, the bad things spread a lot faster than the good things. So I'm very happy to be working with the National Center and building bridges to get the word out about the good things that people are trying to do to, as you said, heal and to reconcile. Because I do believe, I know tens of thousands of law enforcement officers and prosecutors myself, and I'm sure Laura does as well. And these people are dedicated to helping people. They go out every day trying to help people. And they're facing a real tough road. And you said earlier, when people are trying to choose to become a law enforcement officer, they should know this. Well, very few people are choosing to do that now because of the negativity. And a lot of people are good people are leaving law enforcement because of the negativity. And we really need good law enforcement with good community interactions. I will agree, though, that in some circles in law enforcement, there is a certain feeling of entitlement and aggression that I think we need to take away from law enforcement. I think Laura and I interviewed Jim, the researcher.
And Professor James Densley. He's actually English, but he lives in America like me.
Right. And he said, in England, law enforcement operates via consent. Here, law enforcement operates via force. And that's a very different thing. And to know as a law enforcement officer that you are serving people versus ordering people around. There is a way to accomplish your goals without being aggressive, without having a feeling of entitlement. And above all, to never break the law at all. Never. Because if you're the ones enforcing the law, you do not have a right to break it. In fact, you have a higher standard to not break it. So when the few law enforcement officers do break the law, it stains everybody else. And nobody benefits from that. It's simply the same as looking at everybody who looks one way or believes one way as one type of person. And that's absolutely not true. We're all individuals. We belong to many communities and sub-communities, as Laura said, but we're all human beings and we can get along. We can work together.
Well, Richard and Mariana, you are so young to have done so much. It's just incredible. There is so much more that we want to talk to you about and learn about the Building Bridges Project. We have so much more to talk about, so you have to come back. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
Thank you.